This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you want to get ahead in life, you have to learn to make good decisions, and that should start at an early age.
They're old enough in fifth grade to understand right from wrong. They're starting to see the world a little more broadly through wider eyes, and yet they haven't had the opportunity to really be co-opted by some of the bad elements of society.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a program in upstate New York called The Leadership Project that's working to help fifth graders make good choices. We'll also hear about a new bachelor's degree in homeland security, find out what a warm line is, hint, it's kind of like a hotline, only less urgent, and we'll spend an academic minute learning from our mistakes, with any luck at all. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Trying to reach children before they make the wrong decisions that could lead to a life of crime is the goal of the Leadership Project. It's a voluntary program aimed at fifth graders in schools across New York State's Capital District. 80 people from federal, state, and local agencies go to the schools to encourage good decision-making. The Leadership Project is the initiative of the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of New York, Richard Hartounian. He spoke about the project with The Best of Our Knowledge's Brian Shields.
Brian, this began back in 2011 as a kind of an outgrowth of a big gang investigation and prosecution that we did in Albany involving a gang that was terrorizing the north end of the city, the Jungle Junkies, they were called. And we prosecuted these gangsters and interacted with them in the course of the prosecution. And as we did so, we realized that they had started their bad activities when they were young middle schoolers. They actually called themselves the Looney Tune Thugs, the LTT, or the 588. And that is their code that they use. And they started when they were young. So the investigators and I and my staff thought, boy, wouldn't it be nice to be able to kind of share what a bad idea this was with young people in the city of Albany. So from that, we developed this program called the Leadership Project. It's been a great success.
Why the fifth grade? You speak to fifth graders. What is it about that age group that it's still reachable, I guess?
Because they're old enough in fifth grade to understand right from wrong. They're starting to kind of see the world a little more broadly through wider eyes. And yet they haven't had the opportunity to really be co-opted by some of the bad elements of society. So that really is, we find, the target age to reach them. They're engaged, they're interested, they're positive, and it's been a great experience.
Who goes out to speak to these children?
We have volunteers from 29 law enforcement agencies, 14 federal agencies, state and local agencies, Albany Police, the New York State Department of Corrections, Homeland Security, all the way up to all of the federal law enforcement agencies. I'm so proud of all the volunteers who take time out of their day to go and interact with the kids. And they come back to a one and say, boy, that was really a worthwhile effort. That was really great to engage with the kids, do something positive, help foster good community relations with law enforcement. And it's been a positive experience for all the volunteers.
We know what a bad decision is, but what's a good decision? What are some of the good decisions that you encourage?
Well, good decisions are using good judgment when you're faced with peer pressure. It's realizing that there are going to be people who want to get into trouble and staying away from those folks who want to find a controversy or trouble. And it's also, you know, putting an emphasis on education, putting an emphasis on sports and doing the right thing and kind of just being positive, living your life in a positive way, respecting your family, respecting your friends. And these are all the things that we talk about through a series of skits, if you will, through a series of role playing, and the kids read and they play roles of good kids and bad kids, and they really, really get engaged.
And I understand you just don't meet with them once. You meet with them four times, 45 minutes each time. What makes that so important about going back?
Well, it's great because, you know, you really get to know the kids. You get to know them on a first-name basis. We use name tense. We talk to them. They get to know us. And, you know, they realize that you're not just there for one quick message. You're actually invested in them. And, boy, they respond in such a positive way. It has surprised me, frankly.
Now, when they say police officer, I think they know what a police officer is. But if you go, What is the U.S. attorney? I mean, do they ask questions about what you do?
Well, a lot of people don't know what the U.S. attorney is, not just fifth graders, but we tell them what we do. I explain to them, as do my members of my staff, many of whom join me spreading out among the schools in the Capital Region, to describe the criminal justice system in the basic terms. You know, there are the roles that we all play as prosecutors and defense lawyers and judges and jurors. And we describe generally for them how the system works. You'd be surprised at how much knowledge they have about it, either sometimes, sadly, through personal experience with their family members, but what they see on TV and what they hear in school.
What do they tell you about their lives, that the decisions they have to make on a daily basis? I made this decision. I made that decision. What do I do if someone wants to give me a gun, for instance?
You know, you'd be surprised that some of them have faced those scenarios already in fifth grade, which is why I think it's the perfect target age. But they have described how they have family members who are in prison who have done things. They've sometimes say they've seen things that are bad or illegal. And, you know, we talk about that, how difficult it can be. We kind of relate to them personally about how hard it can be to steer clear of violence or drugs or gangs or guns. And I think when you kind of relate to them and explain that you've had similar experiences and you know people who have and who've been able to navigate, I think they find some hope in that.
Is this just for the city kids? Do you talk to the kids in the suburbs as well?
You know, we've been targeting some of the city school districts, but I think the program would work great, and we've been expanding it every year. And you know, my hope is that we're gonna kind of spread out and expand, because the message isn't just violence and gangs; it's drugs. I was in Washington this week testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee about synthetic drugs. A terrible scourge that we're seeing plague young people at a little older age in fifth grade. But still, the message is there, and it's the same. You got to steer clear of this stuff.
Not just drugs, not just gangs, but, for instance, some of the day-to-day threats that kids face, like bullying. Does that come up?
Well, that comes up, especially in the context of their work with computers and cell phones. We talk about cyberbullying. We talk about getting into trouble texting and, you know, using electronic media and social media improperly, how hurtful it can be, how everybody has a cell phone that takes pictures and videos. And so we start to sensitize the kid to this whole broad range of challenges that the new world is presenting to them.
Richard Hartunian is the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of New York.
And that report from the best of our knowledge is Brian Shields. Okay, let's stay in northern New York for just a little bit more. The University at Albany has launched a new bachelor's degree program in emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity. The best of our knowledge is Dave Lucas reports.
In May, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that the first seven students graduated with the newly created undergraduate minor from the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity, located at UAlbany. The minor was launched ahead of schedule in May 2015. A year later, the school says the six-course minor had an enrollment of more than 275 students, exceeding targets. Brian Nussbaum is an assistant professor of public administration.
The sort of projected number of people who were going to be involved in the minor was 50 students over several years, and within a few weeks we had over a couple hundred people who signed up for the minor. There are some of those students in areas that you might expect, like criminal justice or political science, who are interested, but there were also students from the School of Business and from the biological sciences.
Now the college has received approval from the New York State Education Department to establish the bachelor's degree program in emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity at the start of the next academic year this fall. Interim Dean David Russo says the college, with its deep array of courses, is the first of its kind in the United States.
The day doesn't go by when you don't read about something related to severe weather caused by climate change, terrorism, cyber attacks. It'll allow us to move forward in both research but teaching as well as service in these areas.
Nussbaum says there will be no shortage of need for graduate services.
In a perfect world, we wouldn't have to have these functions, but unfortunately it's not a perfect world, and we do have to have these functions. And what we want is the best people and the most well-prepared and well-equipped people to sort of go in and help with us responding to what are, you know, often bad days, whether it's a terrorist attack or a cyber intrusion or sort of a natural disaster. We want professionals who can really sort of show up and respond effectively.
The new major is designed to be a broad liberal arts degree with a core curriculum of 6 classes, including
things like critical thinking, communication, ethics, leadership, as well as substantive areas like homeland and emergency preparedness and cyber. The experiential learning component really is designed to allow students to take what they learn in the classroom and apply it in a real-world setting. So they'll have small research seminars working on real-world problems.
Nussbaum adds all the students will do internships.
All the students will take part in professional training, and all the students will work on a research capstone project for an external client. So some organization, whether it be a state agency or a business, will come up with a series of questions, and the students will work in teams supervised by faculty to sort of put together presentations or white papers or other things that those clients would benefit from. The goal is really to make this as applied and connected to the real world as possible.
Aside from global terrorism, there are other international problems and issues facing the next generation.
Think of the immigration debate in the United States as well as the immigration crisis in Europe. This program will have courses on immigration and border security. We're also offering courses in public health preparedness to deal with things like Zika and Ebola in conjunction with our School of Public Health. And we're working in areas of cyber security and everything from digital forensics to areas like cryptography and others.
UAlbany President Robert Jones hails the new major as a key component of UAlbany's academic expansion. Earlier this year, Governor Cuomo announced that the University at Albany will redevelop 12 acres in the southwest corner of the Harriman campus to construct a new emerging technology and entrepreneurship complex to house the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity, as well as the headquarters for the New York State MesoNet, a state-of-the-art weather observation system developed to support better planning for extreme and dangerous weather events. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
Still to come, if you don't need a hotline but still want to talk, try the warm line. That's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. 70,000 people call San Francisco's suicide crisis line each year. Making that call usually means someone is on the verge of harming themselves due to severe emotional distress. But San Francisco has launched a new service that's aimed at reaching people before they're on the brink of crisis, the San Francisco Mental Health Peer-Run Warm Line. From the program Cross Currents, Audrey Dilling reports.
So here's a scenario you might relate to. Let's say it's late at night, you've got a big presentation at work tomorrow, and you're not prepared. You've just had too much going on in your personal life, and now you're freaking out. You can't sleep. It would really help to talk to someone, but no one's around. Well, there's actually a number you can call in situations like these. And if you dial it, you might hear this on the other end.
Thank you for calling the San Francisco Health Peer Warm Line. This is Daisy.
Daisy Mathias is one of the counselors at San Francisco's Warm Line, a peer-run support line for people who need someone to talk to.
Then it's your turn. Like, you could tell us what you want. You could just open up. In fact, if you need to bawl out, just cry. Or you could say, I'm stressed, I'm lonely.
Being a peer counselor means Mathias has dealt with a lot of the same issues that people are calling her about. She's not a certified therapist by any means, but she has other qualifications.
For example, I'm a person who has been diagnosed with a learning disability, a person who has social anxiety, and I don't know what else.
You don't have to be diagnosed with anything to call, and you don't have to be in crisis. That's one big difference between the warm line and suicide hotlines.
You don't really need to have a mental health issue to call the warm line. If you're stressed out and you need someone to talk to, that's enough for us to be here.
What it does is that it provides a space for people to talk about things before they reach a level where it would be considered a mental health concern.
Melody Jarvis has managed the warm line since it launched less than a year ago. It started with funding from a state grant. The goal was to reduce hospitalizations for mental health issues and improve access to support services. Warm line counselors are trained to refer callers to affordable therapy options.
And I remember our very first day, I was training all the new counselors who were here, and we only received one call our first day. But then very quickly, we started receiving more and more calls. And then now, we receive up to, 70, 80 calls per day.
It turns out a lot of those calls are coming from outside the Bay Area. And the Warm Line's online chat service is actually being used by people around the world. This wide reach says something to Melody Jarvis.
I think it's a sign that this is a very necessary service that's needed in every county and every state.
Jarvis says part of the Warm Line's appeal is this peer support thing. In a more traditional situation, a therapist or whoever answers a crisis line doesn't usually reveal anything personal. But Jarvis has found that hearing from someone who's been there before does a lot for warm line callers.
For example, somebody might call and say, I've just started this medication and it's making me feel really nauseous all the time and it's just really hard to get through my day. Well, our counselors, as peer counselors, can say, yeah, I've taken that medication too and it made me really nauseous when I first started taking it. And then here's how I coped with that, and here's how that I was able to get through that and move on. So, I mean, that kind of thing is sort of revolutionary.
But the great thing about our line is we don't necessarily have to sound like that, oh, what seems to be the problem? It's just, it sometimes can feel like you're talking to a friend.
Warm line counselor Daisy Mathias says that feeling is something she could have used when she was struggling with her own mental health, starting back in high school.
I come from a very, I'll just say this, very traditional Catholic family from Mexico, and I'm a very liberal, pagan, feminist, on top of that, I was also that weird goth girl in school.
Is your hair always that color?
Well, for people on the radio, if you can't see, my hair color is a yellow, and then goes orange, red, dark red, and then purple.
So pretty early on, Mathias started looking outside her home for someone to talk to.
Well, I didn't grow up with the most wealthy family, so I didn't really have very good internet access at the time. So I mostly used the 411, but they mostly transferred me to crisis lines. But there were moments where a crisis line would not be the one to help me because I needed to talk and vent, but since they're trained to handle people who are in crisis who will hurt themselves, I didn't feel I could go to them immediately.
Now, as a warm line peer counselor, Mathias gets to have that conversation she needed all the time. She's just on the other end.
For me, I actually enjoy some of the conversations we have. I can't really list any examples.
Mathias is incredibly protective of what her callers share with her. Everything is totally confidential.
But I will say that there are people who call that have anxiety that actually help me, because not only do I share things that have helped me with my anxiety, they tell me things that help them with their anxiety. And I say that one because that's what I have. And it ends up benefiting in both. And it's so great to hear some common stories that we all have.
There's stories that don't get talked about out in the open very much, but there are lines open for them, for as long as people need to vent or just feel heard. Once that happens, Mathias says the call usually ends like this.
I'm done venting. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Right now, like the handful of other warm lines around the country, the San Francisco warm line operates on limited hours. But manager Melody Jarvis says the plan is to go 24/7 as soon as possible. For Cross Currents, I'm Audrey Dilling.
Sometimes you don't need to talk to somebody to figure something out. Sometimes you just have to royally mess up. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
It pays to learn from your mistakes. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Samuel Sober, assistant professor in the biology department at Emory University, explores which part of our brain avoids making the same error twice.
Our brains are constantly learning from their mistakes. This is especially important in skilled behaviors such as speech, where the brain monitors the sound of our own voices and uses this information to correct errors in our vocal production. Songbirds perform similar feats of vocal learning, using sensory information to modify their songs in response to auditory inputs. Although we know a lot about how sound is processed by the nervous system, it remains a mystery how error signals are transmitted to the parts of the brain that control behavior. Our laboratory recently used songbirds to test a hypothesis about how error signals are transmitted during vocal behavior. Bengalese finches are songbirds with extremely precise singing behavior and are highly sensitive to errors in auditory feedback. We used these birds to test the hypothesis that error signals are carried by the neurotransmitter dopamine within a small part of the songbird basal ganglia, a brain region known to be involved in learning. We tested the bird's learning abilities by playing blasts of loud noise whenever the bird sang within a particular range of vocal pitches. Over time, finches changed the pitch of their songs to avoid these bursts of noise. We found that experimentally reducing dopamine in a small part of the songbird's brain did not interfere with the bird's song performance or motivation to sing, but dramatically reduced the bird's ability to change their songs to avoid auditory errors. Our results suggest that dopamine regulates vocal learning by transmitting error signals to the motor system. Our future work will examine how dopamine regulates patterns of brain activity during learning, and we hope to use this work to shed light on the learning deficits that can accompany neurological disorders in humans that alter dopamine function.
That was Samuel Sober of Emory University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the American Association of Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address for those who still use email is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.